Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan's. Last week's murders in South Carolina are forcing us to look at all the ugly truths that haunt America, among them racial tension in the 21st century and the scourge of gun violence. Here with us in Studio 3 for their take on this are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Reverend Irene Monroe is a religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price, a professor of music at Northeastern University. Good to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Thank you both for coming in. So let's start, Irene, with what you wrote about in The Globe, about our refusal to have an honest conversation about race in America. We've been going to have it now for about 30 years, but we never seem to quite get around to it. What's your thesis?
Well, I wrote the piece because in many ways I wanted to sort of, believe it or not, Jim, dole out redemptive hope here.
Oh, good.
And I wanted to talk about the various kind of roadblocks that we have that prevents us to have this kind of conversation. And some of it is certainly white guilt and the issue around black rage. And how do we mediate that kind of tension? And the reason why this is important, because while clearly Dylan Storm, is his name Storm or
Roth?
Roth.
Okay, his middle name is Storm.
Roof. Oh, it is, really?
Yeah, Storm Roof, yeah. While his act is an explicit act of bias, it's the implicit acts that really builds up and that we don't have an ability to talk about. So I think what concerns me too, it's like we'll call, this act a hate crime as opposed to domestic terrorism. People will talk about the Confederate flag as a symbol of heritage and understand that they wouldn't do this with the swastika and not understand that the Confederate flag is certainly a symbol of hatred. So it's this kind of not having a conversation about hate. We don't really understand what really is happening here because we're sort of tiptoeing.
You know, Emmett, since Irene uncharacteristically is upbeat about the potential for a conversation, I'll put a damper. No, I actually won't. I'm going to encourage it. And Nikki Haley, who's the governor of South Carolina, is having a press conference at 4 o'clock this afternoon. I have to assume, unless she's saying she's leading a charge to take down the flag, the Confederate flag, she wouldn't be doing it. But I could be wrong. Barack Obama is as emotionally engaged, it seems to me, on issues of race as I've seen him in the 7 years, eight years, he's been on the national scene, even using the N-word on this podcast that was released in the last handful of hours. Is it possible that the ice is breaking just a drop after, in light of those two things, after this horrific set of murders in South Carolina?
Of course. I mean, I'm the utopian optimist, and I like to think that I've had a little bit of influence on Irene here, who's actually advocating for this conversation. Her piece in The Globe was phenomenal. I think it really captures the notions of what needs to happen. But I think, yes, the ice is breaking. We're still dealing with the bandages, right? So this is not a gun issue. It's not a flag issue. Hopefully, Governor Haley will settle the flag thing at 4 o'clock, as you mentioned, Jim. The gun piece, I don't know. I mean, there's a standstill in Congress. But this is really an issue about the American consciousness, right? Who are we? Who do we want to be? And how do we relate with one another, right? It's a racial issue, yes. It's a climate control issue, yes. It's an issue of all these other things. But it's much bigger. It's about who, when we're citizens of this great nation, what are we buying into? What are we believing? And what are we believing about one another?
But Emmett, don't you think that a first act of sort of racial reconciliation on some level is to take down that Confederate flag? Because I think to honor the death of those 9 victims, these are people that were born under that flag. My God, do they have to die under that flag?
Well, I agree with you, Irene.
But the reason I'm raising this question is because a lot of times the good intentions of white folks are, where do I begin? Well, I think one of the acts that they clearly see that they all could come, we all come to a consensus on this, even Jeb and Mitt Romney, is that take that flag down. And I think that would start a beginning about race.
Let me ask you guys a bigger question, though. I mean, we do have many discussions.
Yeah.
O.J. Simpson, everybody talked about, not everybody, African-Americans talked about how they'd been, pulled over by the cops. That was one kind of the big nationwide. Everybody gets pulled over by the cops, gets mistreated by the cops. Then we had Trayvon.
That changed a lot of things,
It did not. But I'm saying we have these conversations in the media. Trayvon Martin had a big conversation in the media. Would Trayvon Martin have been shot if he was a white kid in a hoodie? I think most people said no. No, we wouldn't have, and we had these conversations. And then So where do we go from here? I think one of the problems with the conversation is not only is Black America so different. You know, it's not a monolith at all, really. And you have the Caribbean Blacks and you have the African Blacks and all that. Then you have white people who are this massive monolith. People that came in the Mayflies, hardly any of them. People that just got here. People that are dark-skinned white, like Muslims, are they white? You know, all these things. So how do you have this conversation?
But I think if you deconstruct this notion of white privilege and white supremacy, I think that you get at that. And I think that one of the things that we have not been looking at is...
white people don't feel
very
supreme.
This is my point. I think that what we have been ignoring, a particular demographic group, and why we're seeing such a rise of hate groups is disaffected young white males. It's this group, and it's not to exonerate other folks who also exhibit racist behavior, but it is this group that you see a resurgence of the skinhead. This young man, even though he didn't belong to the neo-Confederate hate groups that are certainly rising up in the South, and there are 19 of them, you know, there in South Carolina, and by the way, there are 8 here in the state of Massachusetts, is that when we just look at race and that don't look at the intersections of how class plays into that.
Which is huge, I think.
And when we color poverty, because there's a correlation between hate crimes and poverty, when you color poverty as Black, you disenfranchise or you make invisible a particular group. That's that boy's group.
Well, I mean, let me go back to your question, Marjorie. The Confederate flag has been flying in South Carolina since 1961, and all of a sudden we're aroused by it. I mean, come on, right? I mean, is that going to resolve the conversation there? People are easy to say that this young man who created this, you know, horrific act of killing these 9 people is crazy. He's deranged. And so that ends that conversation, right? Because we marginalize people who are different and who don't believe the same things that we believe. And we never get to the point that there's a huge population of individuals in this country who believe the same things that he believes. And until we allow that to be a platform and be able to have a conversation across these platforms, then we're not going to have the conversation, because we're going to assume that people who think that way are crazy and we can just kind of push them to the side.
Two statements, I guess. One to you, Emma. The one statement, since I've never said a good word about Clarence Thomas, I should say it today, is while many of the people running for the presidency don't get it,
Clarence Thomas
was the deciding vote with 4 liberals on the whole issue of Confederate flag as their constitutional free speech
right to have it on a license plate.
But whatever, he did it. But getting back to the issue you mentioned about is he crazy, meaning this roof guy, there's a whole debate that's going on. It's going on in our newsroom. It's going on in the New York Times about how, as Americans, when a Muslim commits an act like the Tsarnaev brothers did, they're terrorists.
Sure.
When somebody like Ruff, a white guy, shoots 9 Black people, he's not branded a terrorist. Sure. He's either crazy or we're looking for some excuse, as the New York Times says. Is that a conversation we have to have about whether or not we choose to brand it as terrorism and as whether or not we brand different things that are really the same thing, terrorism, and some
absolutely.
Not?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it points to...
Why does it matter?
Well, it matters a lot for a lot of reasons. One, to label him as mentally ill, his act as mentally ill, it does 2 things. You don't want to have the conversation about race. That's number one. But number two, it doesn't allow for any culpability about this act, and also accountability to him and to the community that is harmed by this.
Well, forget the mental illness issue. Let's just assume there was a consensus, which there is not. But let's assume there's a consensus. This is a hate crime. But we don't want to say the word terrorist, or we choose not to say the word terrorist. Does it matter?
Yes, it does, because we've had a century of domestic terrorism because of the Ku Klux Klan, and nobody have ever wanted to call that particular group a domestic terrorist group, but it was. This is a guy that is shaped by that particular ideology, and very much wanted a race war. So there's a political aspect to it, you know, as well as for him a very personal aspect to it, and he used the typical sort of racist trope that, you know, the Black men are killing our white women, you know, not understanding that one of the reasons why there are various complexions of Black people has a lot to do with white rape in America.
Well, I mean, this is an indictment of so many different things. And it goes back to why we are not courageous enough to have the conversation because it means that everything is going to change, right? The entire ecosystem of how we do things in this country, from education, right, to politics, to, you know, economic equality or lack thereof, to political disenfranchisement, I mean, has to change. I mean, when you have the magistrate who stands there at the first hearing and goes into this thing about how Ruff's a family are the victims here. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, what are we doing here?
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting you say that. Is that for those who didn't see this little magistrate there, who's had some problems, been disciplined for things in the past, at the same time, he does proceed. I wish we had the sound available. He does talk about the nine who were murdered, but sure. He said there are other victims here. The family, he doesn't, I don't know if he calls them the shooter, whatever he calls them. At the same time, I was – you have very strong feelings about it and very upset about it. I had mixed feelings because I say on one hand, a woman we talk about a lot on the show, Tina Cherry, whose son Lewis Brown was killed on his way to a peace rally on Christmas Eve or something, led her to found and do the wonderful work she does with Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. She talks about victims on both sides.
Absolutely.
Of every killing. So why is it – oh, I don't mean this as a harsh question. I mean it – as a confused question, why is it okay when she says it and it's not okay, and you seem to be in the vast majority of people who are upset about this, when this magistrate in South Carolina says
It's okay when the family of the nine say to him, we forgive you. Mm-hmm. It's not okay
Which was
when
incredible.
It's not okay when the authority, when the judge
That's right.
From the platform of the judicial system says, hold on, y'all, don't get all sympathetic about these folks. There are some other folks we need to care about,
and
too.
And the tone and tenor at which he...
The tone was the problem.
It was really problematic. Right. And a lot of people seem perplexed by how forgiving the community.
I was perplexed, and
I'm not there, but
hey, why shouldn't we be perplexed? I thought it was one of the most amazing things I've ever heard in my life.
It is amazing. It's
the tenet of Christianity. I mean, Luke 23, where it says, you know, Father, forgive them for what they've done, because they know not what they've done. I mean, forgive them for what they do.
It's bigger than that.
But it's the tenet of Black survival. But it is also, in my opinion, a prophylactic against white homicidal ideation. How else could you do this?
What does that mean in English?
Meaning you to go out and kill white people. I mean, how do you not? This helps them to not go out and riot. Uh-huh. Okay, so I think that that's important.
This is part of the kind of Black experience in this country. When you don't have access to political power and you don't have the economic currency to be able to make change, to systemic change, you have to say, you know what? We believe that at some point,
somewhere,
other folks, you know, will be touched by God or Allah, whomever, to feel as compassionately as we do about this situation, so that we'll no longer be in solitude. And because we can't deal with it by ourselves, we would all go crazy, and you'd have all kind of foolishness going on in the country.
And the thought of it, I mean, one of the questions I raised in a previous segment with you both was that what safe space do we have, you know, in America for as Black people? And if you have no sanctuary in a Black sanctuary, where do you go? And the interesting thing about it is that while it clearly reminds us somewhat of the 1963 bombing of the four little girls that were killed at 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, we forget that the night that Obama was elected president, that Macedonia Baptist Church in Springfield was burned down and stuff. And there have been an ongoing burning of Black churches. What makes this so horrendous is that there were victims where there have been a burning of Black churches.
So I hate to put you on the spot, Reverend, but were either of you in church over the weekend locally?
Yeah, we had to go.
Well, in addition to being a professor of music, I actually pastor a church, right?
Yeah.
Community of Love Christian Fellowship.
So tell us what happened yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard weekend, right?
Yeah.
Because you're answering these questions from individuals who are your parishioners, who are not your parishioners. And you know me, I'm in the love and hope business.
Right.
So I'm consistent. I'm love and hope. Even in the midst of this crisis and storm, you know, we profess and confess to learn how to love one another and to let each other's hope propel us forward so that you don't get misguided. Right. The fact is that you got to stay focused on God's plan and don't get, you know, focused or sidetracked on some of these obstacles or whatnot. So we can you know, recommit to loving one another and figuring out what it means to love one another, even amongst our differences.
So was that a hard argument yesterday?
It's a hard argument every day. But this weekend was a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, because I don't think people understand the tentacles of this impact, that even though it happened in South Carolina, you have parishioners, family, and friends who live up here, who have family in South Carolina. And so you have to, at some point, while you want to talk about, you know, how awful this incident is, you have to talk about how we move forward. So that's why one of our anthems, "We Shall Overcome," gives us redemptive hope. I know you find this shocking.
No, I don't. Shocking is not the right word. I don't know if you heard us at 12 o'clock. I am rarely despairing, but my notion was that we really can't fix anything in this country. Whether it's something as mundane as crumbling roads and bridges, a racial tension, gun violence. And again, I don't want to connect it to what happened there, because probably there's no gun legislation that we would all embrace that would have stopped this young murderer from doing what he did.
I'm done with that. Exactly. I'm done.
Well, let me give you some redeeming hope.
Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, please.
So, you're the one that's in love and hope business.
He's in love and hope business.
The fact that now we can trace, donations to some of the Republican candidates that have come from these hate groups.
Yes.
And now people are suggesting that they're going to give the money back, right? Perhaps at 4 o'clock today, we will get the flag down, right? I think there are some small, you know, moments of progress. The fact that on Sunday, you had this great response by individuals of all ethnicities, hues, races, genders, whatnot, who sojourned down to Charleston just to hold hands across this bridge. I think there are moments, you know, churches are ringing bells on Sunday, you know, in solidarity with Mother Emanuel.
But you contradict yourself, because you said you didn't think the flag would bring about change.
It won't, but it's a sense of hope. Hope has to happen in fragments.
Well, it's an acknowledgement. It's an acknowledgement,
solve it.
No, that's a systemic change. That Confederate flag, because that flag flies throughout the South. And so, no, I think that's important. And the fact that you got a mayor and governor.
We don't know if we have a governor yet, we should say. We're assuming what she's doing at 4 o'clock. The mayor spoke earlier today, Joe Riley.
This conversation dies when the flag goes down, the shame on all of us.
I couldn't imagine, because first of all, the reprisal of taking that flag down, that is going to open up a conversation whether we like it or not, and we can't control the tenor of that. But no, I think that you take that flag down, because that's all I could think about. See, we live up here and we don't see the Confederate flag, except for I officiated a wedding in Maine, Algonquin, a gay friendly place, and I can never forget when I was officiating this and a truck of white boys came by and used the N-word at us. It was a black gay wedding that I was officiating, and I said, well, you see, this is why that Mason-Dixon line, we ignore that. We use it as a distinction to say up South versus down South.
Listen, my son plays Pop Warner football or town football, and there's a certain place where we play where there's a flag hanging next to the football field.
In Massachusetts.
I mean, so come on.
So
you want to tell us where?
No, I'm not going to say.
Okay, off the air. I'm going to get that out of here.
He lives nearby. Yeah, you can't put him in jeopardy.
We're talking to Emmett Price, Reverend Emmett Price, and Reverend Irene Monroe. We only have 2 minutes left, but Irene, since you are in probably the most positive mood you've ever been in on this show, can we give high marks to the Pope for this encyclical? This is Pope Watch for those who missed it. For
absolutely.
This encyclical on climate change?
Oh, absolutely. But the Pope has spoken out about injustice across the world. I'm hoping that what has happened in South Carolina, that he will speak out about that. And what better way to begin that? Talk about taking down that flag. So I'm hopeful.
I wonder if the Pope will weigh in on the flag. Seems a little bit.
It's unlikely.
It's probably unlikely. A little bit too parochial for us here.
Emma? What did you think of the Pope?
Oh, amen.
And do you think it? You know, Marjorie made a very good point that we made with, I don't know who we were talking to,
Charlie
Sennett, is the unfortunate thing about his taking the stand is it was clearly overshadowed in the United States, understandably, by what happened in Charleston. Can you imagine even a devout Catholic who is not of the view that the Pope is saying to him or herself, I'm about to have an epiphany, or let's not even say an epiphany. I'm serious. My mind is cracked open a little bit more than it was the day before. I'm now willing to listen where I might not have been before. Is that
here's
possible?
A moment of agreement, right? And yeah. I think these moment of agreements create a trajectory for us.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah.
And hope. That's absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. Reverend Irene Monroe, thank you for coming in.
I don't think this is the real Irene Monroe, actually. It's
my influence. It's working.
No,
that's right.
But
he works her over in the green room.
I'll tell you what did this. As I told you, you had me on the show some months ago when we were celebrating the anniversary of the March on Washington, and I said I was a little kid then, and it was at that moment, because at that point I was told about the bombing and stuff, and I was a very frightened child growing up and watching all these sort of scenes on 6 o'clock news, and it was always that notion that if we all work together, we can bring about a change.
Great.
So
glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Irene Monroe, Reverend Emmett Price, professor of music at Northeastern University. They join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Coming up, the presidency of George Bush. I think that's where we're going. Is that not correct, Jim? Okay. We're going to revisit the presidency of George H.W. Bush, as in George the First, from his domestic policy achievements to his world-changing foreign policy. It's the subject of a new book by John H. Sununu, who joins us next on 89.7 WGBH.